You're listening to the discussion between Sir Terry Pratchett and Dr. Jacqueline Simpson of the Folklore Society.
When did you first encounter folklore?
Well, I encountered it without actually knowing what it was, giving it any name or anything, when I was a child, I suppose, from about 5 years old onwards, in various different forms. My mother introduced me to Grimm's fairy tales, which I loved, and a little bit later to Hans Andersen's, most of which I hated. And on the other hand, the gardener would say things like, if you cut a worm in half, it can join itself together again, and you can see some of them with a kind of thick bit round the middle, which shows that's what's happened to them. And, what else? Well, for instance, there was the question of treacle mines. Now, you know about treacle mines too, don't you, Terry?
My father, every time he used to drive past Bisham, which is near Marlow on the Thames, he pointed out the treacle mines to me.
How old were you?
Apparently they were, well, that must have been when we were going down to Lyme Regis, so I reckon 7 perhaps.
Uh-huh.
Like all good folklore, it's tantalisingly reasonable. One can imagine treacle mines. I mean, you could, the pit head and all the rest of it, and the guy getting sticky money and having to, you know, and their wives have to scrub them down in the evenings. And it's so easy to go from that point that if you have an imagination, you want it to be true.
Mm.
That was perhaps the first bit of folklore that I heard. But the piece of folklore that I encountered, knowing that it was folklore, was the Wimble Stone on the Mendicks.
Oh, yes,
which
yes.
was at the end of the lane where my wife and I moved not very long after our marriage. I walked up to it and round it and was fascinated by it because there were legends about it. There's all kinds of legends, but I think if it's full moon on
Midsummer's Eve,
the stone will canter around the field. And if you look into the hole it otherwise occupied while it was doing so and saw the glint of treasure, you would have to try and run away with it very fast. Otherwise it would fall on top of you.
Ooh.
By then I was old enough to think, where's the evidence? but as I said when I introduced this in the book that we both co-wrote, about the folklore of the Discworld series, I never dared go up there on full moons at midsummer. Not because I was scared. Well, I was scared. I was scared that it wouldn't do it. While I didn't prove that it couldn't, it might have done. And as I said, there has to be room somewhere in the world for a stone to dance.
Absolutely. Oh, how I agree. And I love these stories that are tied in with the landscape. I think of all the various many forms of folklore, the local landscape legend is my favourite. And actually, it was something local which got me interested in English folklore. I had been interested in Icelandic folklore for some years, but one day some workmen were painting my kitchen and they started talking about Tranntonbry Ring, which is a group of trees on a hilltop about, say, 5 miles from where I live. And they said, you know, if you run around Tranntonbry Ring 7 times at midnight, the devil will come out and give you a bowl of soup. And the other one said, no, George, you've got it wrong. You've got to do it on Halloween at sunset, and it's 13 times, not 7, and it's not soup he gives you, it's milk. And there was a sudden kind of flash in my mind, because I remembered two things from my childhood, going back to childhood again. One was that my dad had said to me, if you run 7 times round Tranntonbry Ring without stopping. Oh, and I may say that is quite a job. Someone in good health, a young, energetic bloke, could do it. But I certainly couldn't have done it at any age, 7 times round that without stopping. Anyway, if you go 7 times round without stopping, according to my father, wait a moment, what did he say? he said, the devil will come out and chase you. Mm-hmm. And he also said that if you counted all the trees in that clump, you would never get the same number twice, and it would hardly ever be the right number. And if it was the right number, the ghost of Julius Caesar and all his armies would come marching across the hills to you, because that is where Julius Caesar landed when he invaded England, which it is not.
So fasten your bonnet right under your chin.
Huffety ringstone round, if you lose your cap there.
I think we start at a different key. Huffety puffety ringstone round.
Oh, I don't have a tune to it.
If you lose your hat, there it will never be found. So fasten it, tie up your bonnet right under your skin, under your chin. Fasten your cloak with a brand new pin. Ask me a riddle and we'll begin. Huffety puffety huff. Now, was that made up?
It was, yes,
wasn't it?
It was.
But it sounds as if it should be right.
And I notice that it is developing variations.
Yes.
Which is, of course, the mark of true folklore. Mm. Because my version, which doesn't have a tune, it's just said, is huffety puffety ringstone round, if you lose your cap there it will never be found, so button your coat right up to the chin and fasten your scarf with a bright new pin, and if we are ready then we can begin. Huffety puffety puff.
There should be the Folklore Exploration Society, so people would go up to these places with a soup detector, obviously, because you don't know what the devil is going to turn up with. But the point is, no one's ever going to do that, because the last thing you've got to do with folklore is prove it.
Yes, yes, indeed.
I mean, why count a ring of stones by putting a loaf on them? That's Badbury Rings, isn't it?
Yes, and also Kip's Coatie in Kent.
Right. No, that's a sheer waste of bread. By the time you've got halfway down, it's going to be birds will be pecking at it.
Yes. Besides, the devil is following round behind you, taking a loaf off here and there just to muddle things.
Okay, well, all you have to do is some mathematician with a stopwatch, just checking, you know, marking the bread, you know.
A story is much better than knowledge. I mean, I don't want to know how many stones are.
It's as good and it's as fun. The reason I really got interested, because moving into the West Country, of course, there seems to be more stuff there. As someone said, the further you go west, the more numinous the landscape becomes. And I remember the Sunday Times once corrected my word numinous to luminous.
Oh,
what can you say?
The modern world.
Now I say, obviously, the man either didn't know what it meant or thought I didn't. So I started reading up about stuff and going to various sites, just for the sheer fun of it, because I'm a fantasy writer anyway, so it's almost part of the job. And one time, we're coming back from a signing tour, and we went past Flitch, Dunmow.
Yes, I think the Dunmow Flitch is lurking on the horizon.
Our car went past Dunmow, and I saw the sign, and I said, oh yes, Dunmow Flitch. And the other occupants of the car were putative adults, at least as old as me, and they'd never heard of it. And I thought, thank goodness there is something like the Folklore Society that can actually write these down somewhere. It's part of growing old. You think of all the things that you know, which you know everybody knows, but then periodically you find out that practically nobody knows them.
And that was one of the things, that and fans writing to ask you what on earth had made you think of having three witches.
Those are the
ideas.
Where did you get the idea from?
Yes, it's agonising, isn't it? Especially for one who's been an English teacher like me, you know, hammering Macbeth into the heads of infants. Where did you get the idea of having three witches? So anyway, then you got in touch with me, did you not?
Well, it wasn't quite like that. I was using a book. I wanted to use magpies because I knew about magpie rhymes and
what. Oh, yes, that's going back a bit earlier.
That's where we first met.
Magpies.
And I embarrass this nice lady with this little anecdote because I'm a writer, and therefore, if it isn't quite good enough, you actually just adjust the facts a little. I wanted to be certain that people knew a magpie rhyme. And so on that particular signing tour, while I was signing to people, I said, tell me the magpie line that you learned when you were a child. And most often, the one that they gave me had the lyrics from Magpie, the children's programme in, what, the 70s, was it? Not that long ago. And I knew that there was a lot more magpie rhymes out there somewhere, and I think Opie had quite a lot.
Yes.
It was a sort of shame that people still had the magpie and all the rest of it, but they had, as it were, a slightly anodyne television version, which did incorporate quite a lot of other versions, but it kept the devil out of it, and Frenchmen, and some of the more interesting bits.
Yes, yes.
And death also.
Definitely no death in a television thing for children.
No,
How dare you tell children that people die?
Yes, but most of the stuff, and I suspect it's for you as much for me, was white knowledge, the stuff that you learn without ever knowing about it. Of course you put two coins on the eyelids of the dead. It just astonishes me that this startles people or they wonder about it. Even into the present day, where I live, when a shepherd's die, other shepherds will make certain, even if they're going to be cremated, there is a little bit of raw wool in the coffin.
Was that done for your friend lately?
I believe it was.
Uh-huh.
I did not take it upon myself, but there were two shepherds. At the... Certainly, it was known by the shepherds as the custom.
Yes, and I picked up my shepherd's lore from the Barclay Wills, the Shepherds of the Downs, and he mentions this wool in the coffin thing, which you have not, in fact, actually explained.
Yes.
And the point is that shepherds, because of the nature of their work, are going to miss going to church very often because they simply cannot leave the sheep alone. So, of course, the great problem is when they appear before the throne of God on Judgment Day, hey, where were you on Sundays? And they will produce this little tuft of wool and say, I am a shepherd. And your phrase about a good shepherd?
We know about good shepherds here. And it's beautiful. Whatever religious persuasion you have, what I've always liked about it is there's a concept of loyalty in all this, and people often misunderstand what loyalty means. Throughout history, the concept of loyalty has meant, I will be loyal to you, O king, O chief, O master, if you remain the sort of person, for the sort of person that I am, to be loyal to. Loyalty is both ways. Yes, we have duties to you. Yes, you have duties to us. And they were applying that to the Almighty, and I thought that was rather good and rather practical, as you would expect of shepherds.
Do you realise that in all this we have lost track of the magpies?
Right. I knew, but then you interrupted me back then, so I was getting ready to say, because between the two of us, we'll go on talking forever.
I hope you've... So there you were in the queue asking.
So I was in the queue, and most of the people were giggling, and I was getting TV magpie rhyme after one another. And then I looked up, and there was this statuesque lady, clearly somewhat fearsome, it seemed to me, with an accent that appeared to be going all round Europe. And I said to her... I said to her, Madam, do you know any magpie rhymes? I am not going to attempt the accent, which is, it will probably be around Oslo around now, but in a very, almost Germanic voice, it seemed to me, she said, I think about 27.
This story has grown.
Of course it has, it's folklore.
Yes. Oh dear, and then the next stage was, and you see, he started talking to me about magpies, and there was all this queue of people behind waiting to get their books signed, so I told him as much magpie stuff as I could think of on the spur of the moment, and said, I know I have more at home, I will go and take some photocopies, and I will send them to you care of your publisher, said I, being very tactful, because authors do not like to give out their addresses. Whereupon, you gave me not exactly an address, but at least a P.O. box number.
Well, those were days, early days.
So, it was great fun. And to think I might... I hadn't known that you were going to be coming to Worthing for book signing at all. It was a friend who rang me up about a week or so ahead and said, could I please, please take a book of hers to be signed. And, you know, if I had been busy that afternoon, and I was so naive, I didn't realise what the queue was going to be like. Book signing was due to start at 5 o'clock. I thought if I get there by 4:30, that should be okay.
But it's from the point of view of an author, it's always nice when you find, A, someone who's an expert, and B, someone who's simpatico at the same time. I found a lady in Winchester who's a specialist in folk song, and I was there for other purpose, but everyone was getting fed up with us singing folk songs at the dining table. But it's great, because for a fantasy writer, someone like that, that gets 30 minutes of my time any day of the week.
You had a nice folk song about larks singing melodious, didn't you?
She is pleasant and delightful on a fine summer's morn, to see the fields and the meadows all covered in corn, and the small birds are singing love songs on each brae, and the larks they sang melodious at the dawning of the day, and the larks they sang melodious, and the larks they sang melodious, and the larks they sang melodious at the dawning of the day. That's only in the beginning. Of course, because of the conventions of folk song, usually, I think a couple of verses later on, it's all about a young girl going to Maidenhead and losing her Aylesbury and all the other stuff that happens. I just love the tune.
Where did you learn it?
I just heard someone who liked singing folk song, singing it. It had the same effect on my mind as the word Vespers has, that kind of feeling of quietness and also the sheer joy of the countryside.
Yes. Yes, it's absolutely lovely, I must say. It's a beautiful song. At any rate, it's a beautiful verse, whatever happens later to the young lady.
You have folklore and folk song and old crafts and all these things, and they tend to come together, and I'm glad to see that these days people are becoming more interested in them again, because in the 1960s there was a general folk revival, and that probably was why my interest in folklore kind of sprang out of that.
Yes, and what made you want to write Folklore of the Discworld, or provoke me into assisting on Folklore of the Discworld?
You into doing it. I once spoke to the Folklore Society.
I was secretary of the Folklore Society at that stage, and I was responsible for inviting Terry to come and give us this lecture. And because I was secretary, I was sitting at the table beside him while he was giving the talk, and I can assure you that in the massed ranks of faces stretching to the back of the room and beyond, and people peering round the door, there was only one that did not laugh, relax, and be happy.
Because I started off by saying, I am a writer, so I think about folklore as a carpenter thinks about trees. It is quite a sensible thing to say. I'm interested in the history of London, which is absolutely superb, because it's impossible to believe the things that happened in the biggest, richest city in the world, in Georgian England, all the way up to the death of Victoria. And that kind of interest is also a kind of folklore, because many of the things that happened then get an aura of folklore about them, and it turns out that it isn't folklore. Have you heard the song Knees Up Mother Brown? Right. Did you know that Knees Up Mother Brown was actually originally based on the terrible murder of Mrs. Josephine Baxter in Bow in 1870, and she was not only killed but dismembered by her husband. Rather similar, have you heard of Sweet Fanny Adams? What happened to Sweet Fanny Adams? Well, she was chopped up apparently by her boyfriend, was that the case?
I believe so, and but so small that it became possible to imagine that she'd been turned into mincemeat and put in a tin.
Certainly that was the rumour among the guys on the Western Front, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. In fact, what I told you about these up Mother Brown is entirely an invention. But the point is, it's how I work. You would be prepared to believe that, because we know how folklore works, that this thing's happened, it becomes a broadsheet ballad or broadside ballad. And so it's honourable murder, and which everyone absolutely interested in. It's got to be honourable. It mustn't be horrible. It's got to be honourable murder to be really honourable, isn't it?
Oh,
Yes. Preferably in a back street somewhere. You know, personally, I've always thought that Sweeney Todd was just a very bad barber. And so it's very easy, as it were, to make up folklore. I would hesitate to say that's because it's made up anyway.
Well, there's always an element of invention. I mean, the invention runs along channels that have been determined by previous inventions.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there is.
It goes round and round.
Yes.
I was reading about the folklore of Ireland, and I got hooked on Lord of the Rings. And so you'd read anything that had runes in it, or fairies, or anything. I was coming across folklore, which was really very interesting, and possibly that might have been where the whole thing really began. You start off with the fantasy, and then you find out that the fantasy may be not exactly as unreal as you thought. And that becomes very exciting, that there were people alive at that time who knew people who had known Biddy Early, the witch of County Clare, around which a folklore has gathered, rather similar to that to Robin Hood, who I suspect was a real person, but who wound around himself, because of the way folklore works, tales of other bandits at the same time. And that really fascinated me. But going through the book, there's a type of folkloric creature called the Pooka, which can take many shapes. And there's one story that was passed on by a farm labourer who was early evening digging away at his potatoes, and he heard this sizzle, and he saw coming across the uneven landscape something like a carpet, but made out of silver. And as it passed over the humps and hollows in the ground, it took the shape of them. And when I read that, a chill went down my spine, because I think, this sounds electrical. This sounds like something real. Fairies, that sounds like something Guinness. About 3 pints of Guinness, I would thought. But the sizzle as it travelled, I couldn't help thinking, that was something.
I'd love to have known what it was.
Yes. Pooka is such an interesting word in itself. It's cognate with puck. It's cognate with Icelandic pooki, which is a small demonic goblin. It's a word that sort of goes from one language to another, and the word itself is a shape change.
I believe the countryside creates folklore in the same way that the mists rise in the evening. I think it just happens. People get feelings. The chill you feel if you walk in this place and all these things. And because we want this. We don't want the world to be too inexplicable. We stand and salute to Dawkins as he goes past, and we shake hands with Mr. Einstein. But we just like to think that's not the end of it. I rather suspect there are people that would give up belief in God than belief in luck.
The other day I was watching a repeat of one of the Sharp plays on television, and his friend, the Irish sergeant, what's his name, I've forgotten. Anyway, the Irishman, when asked whether he believes in ghosts, replies, "I believe in God the Father, the Son, and the she riding on the wind."
Yes, right, Simon. The lovely thing about that series, and Kington's right, was John Tams, who played Hagman, always had the songs of the time.
Yes, and he sings
got, them, and got them exactly right. So if this song had been first written down as being heard in such and such, he made certain if that Sharp episode, as it were, on the calendar that they were working from, hadn't happened by then, he wouldn't sing it at that point. He could only sing it until it had become common currency.
Mm. I wonder who did the advice on. Was it the actor himself who knew all this? Or?
I think John Tans was pretty good about that anyway. And it's, there's lots of people like your good self who fill books with information about this sort of thing.
Yes, though not on the music
side. No, but there you
there,
but there, yes. there, you have an opposite number.
Yes. One of the things I like about folklore in Discworld is that it's not only a rural. Okay, it's all over Lanka, it's all over the chalk, but you also have urban folklore in Ankh-Morpork itself. You have children's games, you have beliefs that have sort of worn down and got distorted but are still there.
The rhyme that I made up for Wintersmith, I can't remember if that ever had a real...
The thing about the iron enough to make a nail.
Iron enough to make a nail. Was it phosphor enough to make a match?
You asked me about that at the time, and I've never found a source for it, but like you, I'm convinced that it was real, or at any rate something very like it was real. I think I remember it being in a sort of science for kids book back in the 30s.
I know I invented the last two lines.
Yeah.
Hands enough to hold a child.
Yeah. Oh, yes. That wouldn't have been. No, that's you. Definitely.
And what was the other one? And time enough for love. Or was it heart enough for love.
Mm. Yes.
And that's why the Wintersmith couldn't quite make a man. Because he didn't understand the last two lines.
When I was saying about the folklore in Ankh-Morpork, I was thinking of things like when Vimes goes back to Cockbill Street, is it, where he was brought up, and sees the kids playing hopscotch.
Oh, yes. But in the running gutters of Ankh-Morpork, they played poo sticks.
Yes, I loved that. That was one of the occasions when I disgracefully laughed for 10 minutes in a public place when I read that.
I make things up. But probably in the German forests in the early Iron Age, there were people coming up with Wotan, thinking about the wind and the sky and the thunder, and I think that's how the gods were built. Uninformed people like me that could make a rhyme or add enough truth to something that might be a lie so that it becomes... so you can whistle it, for example, so that it sticks in the memory and then you tell it to the kids. I'm not boasting about this, I just think that's how it happened. People told stories, people wanted answers. To keep the kids quiet, you told them that's the goblin that looks after the goats or whatever.
And one of the things that's fascinating me at the moment, and which actually is the theme of my talk at the convention, is the nature of elves, which we can extend to fairies in general. Mm. Are they nasty or nice? They are so ambiguous. And it is a problem, I think. Why, through all the long, long centuries of Christianity, did people go on believing in ambiguous creatures like the Puka or the elves, who are neither entirely good nor entirely bad? And I think it's because we are not at ease with the absolute black and white divisions which official Christianity imposes on experience. We experience good and bad luck in an arbitrary kind of way. Suffering and happiness arise in ways that seem to have no meaning. And it's easier and more agreeable in a way to think of ambiguous forces,
yes,
rather than to try to say always that it's God's work or it's the devil's work. I mean, to take a very dramatic instance, changelings.
We're talking about Susan Shoon, aren't we?
Yeah. Supposing you give birth to a malformed baby, or your otherwise healthy little boy, when he's about 18 months old, suddenly develops some mysterious illness that nobody can diagnose and dies, you go and ask the priest what it's all about, and you will be told either that God is punishing you for your sins, or that God has sent you this trial to test your virtue, or that it was the devil doing it. And all that is very difficult to accept, I should think. God knows I've never been in this position, and I am myself a religious person. But still, I do think that the religious reactions to extreme calamity, because they're so black and white, are very harsh and hard to accept.
Can I say, you're still a religious person despite my best attempts?
Absolutely. Well, you're getting somewhere, possibly, or not. But if you think that elves or fairies have stolen your baby and left this little monstrosity instead, in a way, that is putting less guilt on you.
Indeed, it's going the other way. Mm-hmm. In a curious way. This is where the writer steps in.
Right.
You are the person that the fairies chose to haunt or destroy or annoy or to steal from. I think probably also somewhere in there a kind of pride flashes a tiny fin.
Ah, my baby was so lovely that the fairies stole him.
Yes. Almost running parallel with folklore for me is an interest not only in just the history of London, but in the history of the development of the countryside, particularly over the last five centuries, for example. I've found many kind of interesting things there. I've been fascinated by the way folklore was entwined with truth in people's lives.
Mm.
Whatever happens, urban myth, for example, is folklore.
Mm.
It is simply folklore.
Yes.
It's not different from folklore.
No. And the amazement of the older generation of folklorists, indeed the fury of the older generation of folklorists, when young Americans and a few young folklorists also in England started saying we're going to discuss, collect and analyse stories like the Kentucky Fried Chicken and the hook.
Oh, the hook on the bumper.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Do you know Kentucky Fried Chicken?
I don't know Kentucky Fried Chicken, and possibly shouldn't at this point. Do you know about the couple in the mini car?
Bumperty Bumperty on the Hoof?
No, that was another one.
Uh-huh.
That was the fact that, shall we say, they were in flagrante delecto.
Yes, they were flag-hanging dollily, yes.
And indeed, in such a position, I'm trying to put this delicately for those of a delicate disposition.
I am not a delicate disposition, as you know damn well by now.
I know, that's why I was artificially
being... Of course we had these young ladies.
Young ladies. damsels, probably. I mean, I don't know what the difference is, really, whether they make some kind of noise as they walk. But anyway, the positions they had adopted were such that the woman was perfectly okay, the man had a heart attack, and they had to sort of saw things to get him out, and apparently said, according to the story, my husband's really not going to like this, and the medic said, I'm sorry to tell you, madam, your husband's dead. No, that man isn't my husband. And it's my husband's car. And I wondered, did it really happen? And then it was so good, as it were, everyone told it everywhere. Because once I've been told by a doctor, and twice I've read in Sunday by doctors, the story of the doctor called in a little country practice because of a death in a cottage, and he goes up, and there's the old man lying there. And the doctor has to examine him for the death certificate, and comes back down and says to the wife, I have to tell you, your husband's a woman. And the wife would be a bit embarrassed. Well, we never bothered about that sort of thing. It appears that this is one that's probably part of doctor folklore.
Yes, it's never come my way. No, what you've just said was new to me.
They come and go. It's like bubbles that float and then pop.
I'm now going to tell Kentucky Fried Chicken, because I know these two young things don't know it by the look on their face, and you surely know it. And I will tell it as it was first told to me. This was in the times when I was a school teacher.
Mm.
And one day I noticed that a group of sixth form girls were having a very kind of huddled up conversation as I was coming in. And we got talking, and I asked them what was so interesting and exciting. And one of them said to me, well, you know, something absolutely dreadful happened to the sister of my boyfriend, who was out with her boyfriend, and they'd gone to the Odeon Cinema in Worthing, and they had bought some Kentucky Fried Chicken at the shop in Broadwater Street West on their way down there. And because you're not allowed to eat in the cinema, they waited till the lights went down, and then they unwrapped their portions of Kentucky Fried Chicken and they started eating. The film hadn't been going on very long when the girl suddenly said, I must get to the loo. At which stage I noticed that one of the other girls in the class was kind of leaping up and down and wanting to join in, and I was signalling, let the story run its way. So the poor young girl rushes to the loo, and her boyfriend hangs around for a while and waits, and she doesn't come back, and then he gets worried, so off he goes and he calls an usherette and says, look, my friend went in and she hasn't come out. When she's found there sort of rolling about in agony, so an ambulance is called and she's taken to A&E in Worthing, a hospital, and a stomach pump is applied and the boyfriend is waiting, and eventually a medic comes out and says, I have to ask you, what had you recently been eating? And he said, well, we did have some Kentucky Fried Chicken. And the medic says, well, we stomach pumped her and we brought up some bones, and I have to tell you, that was no chicken, that was a rat.
Oh, I had heard a similar one.
Wait, because we now come to the kind of payoff.
Yes.
At that point, the other girl who'd been leaping up and down trying to interrupt,
just like me, yes, indeed,
said, but, this cannot have happened in the Odeon in Worthing last weekend, because exactly the same thing happened in Brighton 10 days ago. I heard about it from my cousin's brother, and it was exactly like that. And at this point, I, who had all this time managed to keep a straight face, said, well, actually, this story has been going around and round and round for 3 years.
The nice thing about these things is the specifics.
No,
it happened in such and such a thing down the road, and the things that aren't specific. A friend of my husband's brother's cousins was told at a wedding. So that in the dock of reality testing, you cannot bring someone who's going to then swear.
And these two girls, but it must have happened because it was her or him who told me, and she or he wouldn't tell a lie. So I said, look, little test of folklore mechanics. Ring up the person it's supposed to have happened to. Can you track them down? Oh, yes, I'll ask my brother. He has her phone number, etc. Ring her up and get her to confirm that it happened to her sister or whatever. And sure enough, of course, they both did this. And they both, within a few days, said, yes, I contacted. And they said, no, it wasn't my sister it happened to. It was my sister who told me. It happened to a friend of hers.
Yes,
and it
sure
always moves the horizon forever and forever as we move.
The truth, of course, is undeniable. It just moves backwards, so we can't quite track it down. I just wondered if I could say to a room full of people at this here convention that Knees Up Mother Brown was actually celebrated, as it were, this honourable murder. Because Sweet Fanny Adams is certainly true, she certainly existed. Not about Minsk, lots of her wasn't found, as I understand. In those days, this was, you know, interesting stuff. People vaguely know this sort of thing. And so the desire to believe that there is some kind of a narrative, that's right, a narrative to the universe, would say, yeah, that would be right. That's what people would do. They would turn this horrible thing into a song.
But how does the horrible murder link up with the words of Knees Up Mother Brown, of which I must confess I do not know more than the first line?
Knees up Mother Brown, knees up Mother Brown, under the table you must go, E-I-E-I-E-I-O, if I catch you bending, I'll saw your legs right off. Knees up, don't get the breeze up, knees up Mother Brown. God, give me jelly deals and pint of winkles, me lovely.
God.
My family came from barking.
Barking mad?
No, I'm just pure barking.
Carry me out and bury me dacent.
Dacent, no, of course.
Dacent. Ah, before your time, old Mother Riley.
That's right, yes.
Yeah, in the 50s. 40s, even.
40s, I believe.
You weren't even born.
Let me think. Oh, Mother Riley and her cow. It was still around. We've discussed this before. We talk about generations, but there is always a kind of a skid.
Yeah.
So you grow up sharing your parents' nostalgia almost. I couldn't possibly have ever heard Garrison Theatre.
No.
But Can I Do You Now, Sir? And I recognise those as jokes and things that got said.
Yes.
I have to explain to these young ladies, this was on the wireless. And on the wireless, on one occasion, there was Peter Brough and Archie Andrews. That was a ventriloquist act. And it went on for years and years. Now, I think the human race is, in a very gleeful, wonderful, enjoyable way, totally mad. So for years, people listened to the ventriloquist act on the wireless, and you know what? They never saw his lips move.
But the difference between the two voices...
Got the gear.
Yes.
Oh, what a wonderful thing to be.
A healthy grown-up.
Filling up the sunlight hours... stealing all the pollen. We're talking different verses.
Yeah.
But the point is, our generation, my generation is slightly younger than ours, to discuss, has a greater sense of history, I think, than the generations behind, because we've lived it, because we've spoken to it. My granddad was in the Dardanelles. Mm. He was one of seven brothers that went to the First World War. They all came back alive.
And
my great-great-grandfather had a letter from the king, you know, thanking him for this.
Yes.
And then my father was in the Second World War, and my mother went through the Blitz, and my uncle was an evacuee. So all these things are real to me. They are not really historical.
No.
And I remember the absolute astonishment when I realised that my father could have shaken hands with Wyatt Earp,
which
is quite unbelievable, but that's because we don't realise that history is actually really very close. In fact, I wrote it in a school book, and I'm writing my autobiography at the moment, and I've used that as a title. I copied it down as I'd done in the old school book, and it just says, my father could have shook hands with Wyatt Earp. because Wyatt Earp lived, I believe, to see himself portrayed on the early cinema. And Tom Mix, the silent actor who played cowboys, wept at his funeral. He had a ride in an aeroplane. I mean, he was a 20th century guy. But we think of him as a historical person. And that brings us back, I think, to our subject. I lived a mile, again, I'm talking about how history kind of clamps together. I realised that my boyhood was very, very similar to the boyhood of my father and my grandfather. Slightly better conditions. I suppose the wireless was around when my granddad was a boy. Certainly with my dad. But in my case, born into a fairly ramshackle cottage that had no running water. The water was a tap. No proper toilets. No gas, no electricity. And my father and my grandfather would have said pretty much the same thing with minor things. But my mother had been educated. She didn't go to grammar school because even bright girls of her class would never get to grammar school. It just couldn't possibly happen. My London grandfather was one of those people that makes certain that the working class always stays the working class. But she told me about the Greek myths on the way to school. And so I was the first kid ever probably to have a tortoise called Pheidippides. We've been not scathing, I think,
about folklore, so I would ask you, well, what are the uses of folklore?
Oh, to reconnect us with our past, to provide material for a lot of fun, to stimulate the imagination.
Could I add one?
Yes.
To remind the kids that things were otherwise.
Very true.
That the human race did not pop out of the ground with iPods. That things were different. This is why I think a study of history is vital. Because, as I always say, if you don't know where you've come from, you don't know where you are. And if you don't know where you are, you have no idea where you're going.
I think that some themes that are found in folk tales, perhaps more in the big fairy tales rather than the local stories, but still, some of these themes help us to understand ourselves, to understand our fears, to give courage and hope, don't you think?
Yes, yes. But also to make life more fun. But not fun, satisfying.
Yes.
I think actually that one of the nice things about folklore is that it is in fact useless. It belongs to us. It doesn't cost anything. It changes, it moves, it disappears.
And I may say that it is a delight to be a folklorist and to work on folklore, because you never need worry whether the thing is true and accurate or not. As soon as you can prove that somebody has said it and somebody else has listened and repeated it, it doesn't matter a tinker's cuss whether it ever happened or not. Did King Alfred burn the cakes? Who the hell cares? The story is what matters.
Did Robert the Bruce see the spider?
Precisely.
But presumably the sight of the spider, or whatever he said he saw, or what someone wrote down that he saw, or someone else thought he saw, just possibly did inspire a few people to try and try again. And I
Absolutely.
Suspect there's people out there who don't know what I'm talking about. Why was he called Robert the Bruce? Why wasn't he Bruce the Robert? You know.
Oh, go on. I don't know. I'm not Scottish.
I say this as a kind of afterthought. I see two young ladies in front of me. I'm not going to ask their ages. I'm going to ask you something. Who was Abraham?
Biblical figure?
A biblical figure. Would you like to essay a little further guess?
No.
Like, effectively the founder of Judaism? Do you think?
Sure.
Or how about Job?
I know about him. I've read about him. He was tested by God. He was very
righty-ho,
man of God. And then God tested him by taking away everything that he ever had, his sheep and his family, and then gave him boils and
yeah.
I'm obviously making most of that.
No, you're pretty well doing. I mean,
so
your imagination is similar to the Almighty's.
Yes. And to try and test him, because the devil said to God, Job wouldn't really be your biggest fan if you weren't so good to him.
Like, biggest fan.
Yeah.
Oh, I've enjoyed all your planets, really.
And I think in the end, actually, Job gave up on God and said, no, this is terrible.
I don't even believe in God, and I think I know that God actually saw, well, you come through it. Well, yeah, and then he became very honoured and all the rest of it.
Yes. Well,
it wouldn't have been good PR. It wouldn't have been good PR the other way.
Well.
And how about Methuselah? According to the Bible, the oldest man, although there is another one, I believe.
There is another one.
He never died. Okay, the oldest one who ended up dying was Methuselah.
That was really very impressive on the Old Testament. Let's try Greek mythology. What's a hydra?
Oh. Up ahead. Is that the hydra?
Yes.
The hydra, the three lots of... A big beast.
It's a multi-headed snake.
Yes. Yeah. Mm.
But
that's
you're kind of Medusa. It's yeah. kind of, you know, probably bits of Medusa, as it were.
Mm.
But that wasn't too bad.
No, it wasn't, was it?
I think my generation was probably the last that would routinely expect people to know names like Abraham, and you would know about Noah.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Because he wasn't very old.
And he danced for God. And he had an animal act, which always gets you remembered.
Yes, it's a pity that Abraham is fading, because Abraham is important, because he's the figure that Jews, Muslims and Christians all revere as being right at the beginning of their religious history.
I said that because, for the likes of us, you think in terms of what everybody knows. And as I've said, it's often a shock to find out that hardly anybody knows what everybody knows. And it's possibly as a result of this that the 20th century is generating so much urban myth, because we've lost the goblins and the fairies, but the axe murderers and the people that bang other people's heads on the roof of cars and the ladies that get stuck rather embarrassingly all come together because we miss that numinosity. Can you have numinosity? I suspect you can.
If we didn't have it 5 minutes ago,
we have it now. Right. We want that bit. We want to know that certainty has frayed edges. Because we personally know that we are full of frayed edges and we quite like the world to be exactly like ourselves.
Yes.
You know what? After two brandies, that came close to wisdom.
And still he spoke, and still the wonder grew that one small head could carry all he knew.
Every kid I know has heard the chimes of midnight, I would imagine.
I would imagine so, yes. Frequently. But will they know where the praise come from?
It was in the mouth of Falstaff.
It's two elderly men sitting drinking and remembering the days of their youth.
And indeed, Shakespeare was largely an inventor of fairies as well, a creator of folklore in his own right, I think. What a piece of work is man, how noble in reason, in infinite and faculties, in form and moving, how express and admirable. In action, how like an angel. In apprehension, how like a god. The beauty of the world, the paragon of animals. I can't remember any Shakespeare, but I can remember Shakespeare if I sing it. And it's,
it's
I'll swear, it's
cheerful Hamlet almost, with the tune.
Well, yes, because, but later on you go, I have of late, but wherefore I know not, lost all my mirth. This goodly frame the earth seems to me a sterile promontory. This great o'erhanging firmament, the air, look you, while it appears no other thing to me but a foul and pestilent congregation of vapours. It always gets West Indian at the end. And actually that was sung in Hair, the musical, which is as far back in time as Shakespeare now to a young person. And actually I thought, this is great. This is how poetry should be apprehended, as song.
I had absolutely no idea, of course, that the Shakespeare passage had ever been set to music. You know, this is news to me. I had no idea.
It was. But to Time Shift, to Read Punch, which was a knowing magazine, a rather like the Private Eye of its time for the young maidens here, you read about the things they took for granted, the things they knew and didn't know. Again, like folklore, it told you that things had once been otherwise, and that's a very important thing to know. And I use that in Nation, in the time when things were otherwise. That's the mysterious place where everything happened. And all folklore has something like in the days when the moon hadn't been born and all that.
There used to be stupid girls that I taught.
Not clever girls, these young ladies who can tell us about the ancients of the Bible.
Oh yes, totally unlike these young ladies. And they would say, what's the point of reading novels? And indeed, you sometimes get adults say, and I'd say, because reading fiction is the only way you can get out of your own skin. When you read fiction, you're no longer a 17-year-old girl in Worthing, middle class. You can be Oliver Twist, a slum orphan. You can go on adventures. You can do anything. Do you want to be forever just you?
I think it's true to say that fantasy and science fiction, to some extent, how can I put it? Tolkien is now practically folklore, in a sense that just about everyone that reads books has read Tolkien.
Yeah.
About having the kind of same effect. Fantasy imbues our society in some ways. Mm. I believe that fantasy and science fiction is now actually being subsumed into what you might call the greater literature.
Mm-hmm.
Because so many people have grown up reading it. It's just the kind of thing you write books about. I get so many letters from mothers that say, my son would never ever read a book, and then he read the Discworld series, and now he's professor of comparative theology at Oxford University. Because it takes you out of yourself. It's like going to university. You're no longer there with mum and dad and the neighbours and your granny and granddad. You're with different people. It may be Bilbo Baggins, and it may be Gandalf, but it's actually increasing the number of people who are telling you who you are.
Yes.
By God, this is double brandy stuff, you know.